Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Today we'll talk about the recent elections. Americans went to the polls on Tuesday and elected a third of the U.S. Senate, 100% of the U.S. House, many governors, and state legislators. What happened? How big was the Republican victory? Why did the Democrats lose so badly? Were there any bright spots for progressives? And what does the Republican victory mean for the country? Here to help us analyze what happened and what it means is Rui Teixeira, a senior fellow at both the Century Foundation and the Center for American Progress. He is also a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution, where he's directed projects on political demography and geography, and written about the shifting demographics of battleground states. He is the author or co-author of 7 books, including America's New Swing Region, Changing Politics and Demographics in the Mountain West, Red, Blue, and Purple America, The Emerging Democratic Majority, The America's Forgotten Majority, as well as hundreds of articles, both scholarly and popular. Teixeira's book, The Emerging Democratic Majority, written with John Judis, was widely discussed and praised across the political spectrum from George Will on the right to E.J. Dionne on the left. It was selected as one of the best books of the year by The Economist magazine. Teixeira holds a Ph.D. in sociology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Roya Teixeira, welcome to All Together Now.
Glad to be here.
So, we have lots to talk about today. Let's start with the big news in the elections, with the Republicans taking over a majority in the U.S. Senate. What happened in the Senate races?
Well, what happened in the Senate races was, to some extent, predicted by the nature of the map that the Democrats had to defend. We knew that, given the distribution of those seats, it was highly likely the Republicans would be able to pull off the 6 seats they needed to get the majority. However, what we did not predict and what surprised a lot of people is just how well they did, that they didn't just take 6 seats. They took what it'll probably be in the end 9 seats, assuming they get the Louisiana runoff and assuming they get Alaska, which looks highly probable. So, and this includes several purple states, of course, that they managed to carry. Like Colorado, North Carolina, and so on. So this was basically a pretty terrible outing for the Democrats, as well as, you know, they lost seats in the House, they lost some governors, they lost the national popular House vote, though not as badly as in 2010. In many ways, it was really a repeat of the kind of drubbing they received in 2010, with roughly the same kind of voters showing up, roughly the same kind of voters not showing up. A lot of dissatisfaction with the administration, with President Obama. They really didn't have an adequate counter. They didn't have a counter message. They didn't have anything people could really articulate about why things might get better in the future, some sort of economic message perhaps that would have connected to people's ongoing dissatisfaction with the nature of the, quote, recovery, unquote. They tried to localize the races. They tried to detach themselves from the national climate and from Obama, and it clearly didn't work.
Right, that's an excellent summary of what happened. Let's talk for a minute about the governor's races. We know the Democrats lost governor races in very solid blue states, like Maryland, Illinois, and Massachusetts. And it looks like we're only going to have 18 Democratic governors next year. Was that the same dynamic that you're talking about playing out there for the governors?
I think it's a somewhat similar dynamic, but I hear with the governor's races, you actually have to – governor's races can be very quirky, and there's plenty of room for political malpractice. And arguably, you know, having Martha Coakley run again for a statewide office in Massachusetts constituted political malpractice. She's a really dreadful candidate. I don't think she's even going to run for dog catcher in the future, and it's not clear she could win that. Losing the governor's seat in Manchin in Maryland, was where I live, was a huge surprise. They just stopped polling the race at all in the last few weeks, the nonpartisan polls, because they figured Brown had it in the bag. But he did not. There was some dissatisfaction with some aspects of what the state legislature had done, including, for example, a tax they were going to put on driveways and such to deal with the failure to absorb rainwater. But what that really plugged into for Hogan was the fact that Democrats just flat out didn't show up. They couldn't have cared less about Brown. They couldn't have cared less about this election. So you had a motivating factor on the Republican side, a very good year for them in general. So even in a blue state like Maryland, they were able to secure the governorship, much to everybody's surprise. I think this means almost nothing about what will happen in 2016, but it does tell you that even in a deep blue state, you run bad candidates and you don't get your people out, and bad things can happen.
Yeah, I agree with most of that, except for the piece about Martha Coakley. Massachusetts is my home state, and I actually know Martha Coakley. People really like her as Attorney General, and she's won repeatedly running for Attorney General, but when she tried to run for the Senate seat...
Maybe she should go back to that.
Well, you know, that's that point. You know, you reach your point of strength and maybe stay there and just keep developing that. But,
True, yes.
People did predict she was going to lose big time, like 7 points, and she said, no, I'm not an underdog. This race is tight. If you look at the results, she actually came very close to winning that. That was really, really a very tight race. So with a little bit of a push, she might have made it over to beat the Republican Charlie Baker. But, you know, I think that national tide was hitting even the blue states, Massachusetts and Maryland, like you were talking about. So let's move on to the U.S. House now. We know the Republicans had a majority before this election. Mm-hmm. They have expanded their majority. Although it's interesting there that despite the frustration and anger of voters, looks like something like 8 in 10 incumbents in the House won re-election. So how do you read what happened in the House? Is this the power of the district lines kind of just playing out, that there's not going to be too much back and forth there, or do you think the Republicans were so strong this year they just kind of swept through?
I think the latter figure has a lot to do with it. I mean, just most incumbents will always get reelected, and a lot of districts are pretty lopsided in their partisan makeup and are simply not vulnerable to change. Realistically, but there are still a lot of seats that are vulnerable in a year in which things move against your party, and that happened this year again, just like it happened in spades in 2010. Basically, if you're in a House seat where you're winning 65% of the vote, you're not in trouble. But if you are winning by a mere 10 points, mm-hmm. these are the kinds of elections that could hurt you. And again, House Democrats typically tried, where they were vulnerable at all, to run away from Obama and the national administration, the national climate. And it didn't really work. Certainly there was no unified message. And now we have what we have. Now the Republicans, they didn't build this all on political mistakes by the Democrats. They built, to some extent, as we know, they're advantaged by structural factors that make the House particularly easy target for them at this point. Part of it is, I think, what everybody knows about, which is the purposive drawing of district boundaries to maximize the chances of Republicans to elect as many people as they can. The second thing is, and they were able to do that effectively after 2010 because they controlled so many state houses where a lot of the redistricting takes place. But another factor that people don't talk less about but is still important and is harder to get around, even if you say, control the state house in the next cycle, is Democrats tend to inefficiently distribute their vote. They live too packed in, close to one another, in more urbanized districts. That means there are too many Democratic districts where the incumbent wins by like 80%. That's like 29% wasted votes, right? The Republicans have far fewer of those seats. They have far more seats where they win with 55 to 60% of the vote instead, which is a much more sensible way to distribute your votes. But that has a lot to do with how people live and where they choose to live. And that's a challenge for the Democrats to figure out how to deal with that.
Yeah. So do you think part of our strategy for 2016 and 2018, we're going to have to ask Democrats to move and spread it out?
Well, that would be that might work, but I don't think we could manage that one. No, I think we'll have to rely on the old tried and true. you know, hoping for a better political environment if the economy picks up quite a bit in the next couple of years and Hillary Clinton runs in 2016, she'll probably be a strong candidate. You might have a bit of a wave then that'll manage to get some get rid of some of these vulnerable, what will now be some vulnerable House incumbents on the Republican side. But it'll be a slog, I think, to get the House back in Democratic terms. And as many people argue, it might not be until after 2020, though I'm always moved to think of when I hear that is that people said exactly the same thing in 2002 and 2004. And of course, given the right circumstances, the Democrats did in fact come back and control the House in that decade. So, and you know, districts change over time. You draw a district in 2010, and you know, 10 years of structural demographic change, and all of a sudden those districts are a little different and a little bit more friendly, perhaps, to your opponent. So I think there's grounds for contestation, even if obviously it's an uphill climb.
Right. Well, let's take a deeper look at the reasons why the Democrats lost so big. You've mentioned no unified message and running from the president. You noticed in today's Washington Post political analyst Harold Meyerson says that the losses are so big the Democrats need to rethink what they offer voters, pointing out that 95% of the income growth since the recession has gone to the wealthiest 1%. And he says the Democrats lost because they failed to deliver a broad, you know, shared prosperity like they used to do. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair point. Their ability to deliver that in the teeth of Republican obstruction for anything that might help the economy, you know, you could certainly argue that's difficult and not entirely their fault. But without being able to deliver that prosperity or at least a plausible plan for doing that that people kind of can get, I do think it makes it very difficult for you. And it makes it very difficult for you in particular, not just do you run the danger, for example, of compressing your margins among groups that are friendly to you, like Hispanics, like young people, but the most serious problem is that while this country has changed a lot and will continue to change over time in terms of the relative weight of white working class voters in the electorate, they are declining with every year, but they're still a big force, and they're still a big force in a lot of states where the Democrats need to be competitive. And in this election, just like in 2010, they're absolutely shellacked among this constituency. That explains, for example, a lot of why they lost the Colorado seat. It explains why they lost the Iowa seat. I mean, when you do as badly as the Democrats do with this relatively hard-pressed group who are not necessarily sympathetic to you to begin with, I think it really makes your task difficult. If you lose by landslides among a big demographic like that, and if they shift sharply against you like they did in this election, you're basically starting out with two strikes and you just got to bat, particularly in an off-year election. Now, in an on-year election and a presidential year, you can absorb a bit more punishment from this group. But in the context of the most recent election, it was a disaster.
Right. Well, and you also mentioned about the Democratic candidates running away from the president, and you know, nowhere was that more visible than Allison Grimes running for the Senate against the current minority leader Mitch McConnell for the Senate seat in Kentucky. And she was actually neck and neck in the polls until they asked her if she voted for President Obama in the last election. She refused to answer and immediately took a deep dive in the polls.
Sure.
Never recovered.
People are idiots. I mean, if you start, sort of temporizing like that, people think, you know, this is ridiculous. She can't even tell us who she voted for. So
right.
I think you completely lose credibility, and it obviously did her no good whatsoever. And I think that's generally true of most of the ways in which they tried to run away from the president. It just wasn't effective. We just have too nationalized a political environment these days overall and in most states that, yeah, it might be great if you could detach yourself from the president when the president isn't popular, but you can't do it. So you might as well make the best of it. And the way to make the best of it is to be honest about where you're coming from and what you actually stand for.
I wish you had been advising Allison Grimes there in Kentucky.
I think she did get this advice from some quarters, but she chose to ignore it.
Right. Well, and what about the Democrats going more in the offense? You know, I was shocked in this election cycle that the Democrats didn't expose more the Republicans' explicit strategy of trying to deny the president any victories. And congressional Republicans on the record, including Mitch McConnell, that their deliberate strategy was to try and knock out the president, not give him any victory, and they blocked the raise of the minimum wage, they're blocking infrastructure that would create jobs, blocking immigration reform, failing to reduce payments on the student loans. It was the Republican strategy to block all of those, and yet that seemed to hurt the Democrats more than the Republicans.
Yeah, and a clever strategy it was. Because, by doing all that, they were actually able to prevent the president from getting any accomplishments in the last period of time. And most importantly, their actions over the last several years have ensured that the recovery was slow enough and annoyingly glacial enough that really, was going to hurt the incumbent administration. They may not have been willing to come out and say it, but they knew perfectly well that the longer the economy limps along and the faster it the slower it takes to recover, the better it was going to be for them in terms of their political prospects. And they effectively did that. Now, if you're the Democrats, what is the point of not calling that out? They're basically running on opposition to Obama and saying no to everything. Everybody knows that's where they're coming from. If you don't address that and say what's wrong with that and what they're really doing, i.e. standing in the way of things that would actually help you and your family, and here's why and here's how, and here's the bills they vote. I mean, how can you possibly expect to do well? I don't get it.
I was astonished the Democrats didn't nationalize that, just exposing what is the explicit Republican strategy to deny the president any victory. And they didn't do it. They left their biggest hammer on the table.
Right, exactly. So, it was going to be a difficult election for them anyway. They may well have done poorly, probably would have, but the level of this debacle could have been mitigated by some more intelligent strategy, I think. And maybe, I'm sure there's some rethinking going on now in the higher circles of Democratic strategy making.
Right, because, some of these races were actually close, like Senator Kay Hagan in North Carolina. She just lost by 2 percentage points. So, a little bit of a shift there, she might have been able to hold on to her seat.
Yeah, no doubt. It was definitely feasible. But, it's one of these, this kind of an environment when you're playing on the defensive and you adopt the kind of ineffective strategy that the Democrats did. I mean, all of these races tend to go in the same way.
Right.
And they did. So, they thought they could escape it again by sort of pussyfooting around the big issues and just saying, hey, I just live in Florida. I just live in North Carolina. That's all I care about. But voters didn't buy it.
And what about voter suppression? There was a lot of concern, and actually has been for a number of years, that part of the Republican strategy is to depress the vote among low-income people, among African Americans, among the youth, which tend to vote very heavily for Democrats. Was there any indication of voter suppression anywhere in the country this year, or was that just kind of a false concern?
Well, that's a good question, and I haven't really seen anything that looked carefully at that to try to estimate what the effects of these laws and these moves might have been. We knew we were going to see fall off in turnout in a midterm election, particularly in one that wasn't arousing any enthusiasm anyway, for reasons we've discussed.
Mm-hmm.
But possibly in some states and in some districts, it was worse than it needed to be. Perhaps because of the things you're talking about. But I haven't seen a study about that. I think probably they'll be coming down the pike pretty soon. So I just leave that as an open question.
Right. Yeah, we'll investigate that a little bit further. And to your point about how the Republicans nationalized their race and made it, this is about President Obama, and register your hatred or dislike of what he's doing or not doing, even though he wasn't on the ballot. But if you look at the exit polls, it showed that 1 in 3 voters said that they were casting a ballot against the president, who wasn't even on the ballot. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that is. I mean, it's pretty relatively high for off-year elections, though it's not, you know, out of the ballpark or anything. There's always some percentage of people who are going to say that, but it was definitely higher this year. Of course, that's two-thirds of the people who didn't vote on that basis. So, yeah, it's. I think it's fair to say, though, that President Obama did, and the perception of his administration and the economy to which he was inextricably linked, yes, really dragged down the Democrats, no doubt
right.
about that.
And there were a few positive things that, you know, the Democrats could have advocated. I mean, Harold Morrison's comment, notwithstanding, about most of the economic gains since the recession have gone to the top 1%. But even with that, you know, the unemployment rate is down to 5.9%. That's, you know, it's been slow but steady progress to getting more people back to work. And gas is cheap, which really the president has very little control over, but they blame him when it goes up, so why not reap some of the benefits when it goes down?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, again, it's this kind of this reluctance to engage. I mean, they know from their political advisors, and everybody knows from common sense, so you can't say, well, unemployment's down at 5.9%, the economy's great, because people
right.
aren't going to buy it. But their reaction to understanding that is to not talk about it at all. I mean, why not say, on the other hand, yeah, it's down to 5.9%. It should be lower, and we should have incomes going up. And here are the reasons why it isn't. We could be doing even better than that, but who's gotten in the way? Who's failed to pass this and that bill? Who's failed to spend money on infrastructure? Who's failed to raise the minimum wage? Whatever. I mean, you know, there's a raft of things they could bring up. But that would be a sort of, you know, at least potentially compelling message to some voters. It's certainly better than pretending, you know, not talking about it at all and not trying to take credit, as you say, for some of the good things that have actually happened. You're potentially leaving votes on the table.
Right. And what about women in this election? We know, you know, the gender gap seemed to disappear in the last election, but, you know, coming roaring back. What role did women voters play this election cycle?
Well, one thing we did see, for example, is that there was an unusually large fall off in turnout among women. So that, for example, in Colorado, there was a 3 percentage point drop, I think, in the percent of voters who were women. So you actually wound up with an electorate, maybe it was four, an electorate that was predominantly male in the Colorado senatorial election, which is quite unusual these days. I think it was 53-47. Men over women. So even though women voted much more for Democrats than obviously men did, there was a big gender gap. They apparently weren't, on the other hand, too enthusiastic about coming out, and men were apparently more motivated. And men also shifted farther in the Republicans' direction than women did in this election relative to 2012. So, you know, women were good for the Democrats, but not nearly as good as they should have been. And men were worse for the Democrats than they really should have been. I mean, they really can't afford to get shellacked.
Right. So,
you know, phrase so badly among these kinds of voters.
Right. Nationally, the exit poll showed that 53% of the women voted Democrat versus 46% for Republican. So we've got a 7% gender gap spread, but again, it just wasn't enough to tip these races because it was just such a heavily Republican wave this year. And there were some victories.
Sure, it's down from 2012, where they were actually substantially more Democratic for the House. They were 55-44 for House Democrats in 2012, only 51-47 this year. So there is a fall off in support among women, and then an even greater fall off in support among men, thereby widening the gender gap.
Right. And there were some victories for women. We have, for the first time, Rhode Island will have a women governor because Gina Raimondo won. New Hampshire voters have been very kind to women candidates. They reelected Governor Maggie Hassan and Senator Jeanne Shaheen, although we were all biting our fingernails for Senator Shaheen's reelection.
The only cheerful news of the night, practically.
Right.
I actually thought when Shaheen was clearly going to win and, you know, the Kay Hagan race hadn't gone south yet, I said, well, okay, this is bad, but maybe not really bad.
Right.
But that turned out it was like, that was it. The New Hampshire thing was it.
Right.
That was all the good news. The rest of it was down into the black hole.
So. Right, exactly. Well, you know, New Hampshire is a fascinating case because we had Republican Scott Brown, who had run for the U.S. Senate seat in Massachusetts, actually held it after Ted Kennedy died, and he beat Martha Coakley, took the Senate seat to fill it out for a couple of years, and then when he ran for re-election, he lost to Elizabeth Warren, the new rising star in the Democrats. So he picked up his marbles and moved to New Hampshire, tried to run for the
right.
U.S. Senate in
Well, as all the wags were noting on election night, what's next for him? Maine? You know, he's just going to go farther north and try that? I mean, yeah, I think he may have run out of territory there. We'll see.
Right. I'm actually really surprised that Scott Brown didn't run for governor in Massachusetts, because I think he actually could have won. He would have beat Martha Coakley there for the governor's race. But
yes, yes. No, that is, he may be kicking himself about that.
Right. Maybe he likes to give speeches more than make decisions. I don't know. And speaking of Massachusetts, we have the first openly gay attorney general. It's the Mara Healey one attorney general there and to take over from Martha Coakley's seat that she vacated to run. So we have some bright spots for women. And, of course, Elizabeth Warren, who we mentioned, is the most popular Democrat on the campaign trail this year in red and blue states. And she's got the message of taking on Wall Street, reducing student debt, and expanding Social Security. Do you think that's the kind of message that Democrats should be taking on nationally to look for more victories?
Well, I think it's a reasonable approximation. I mean, exactly how you would do that as, you know, a presidential candidate, for example, in 2016, I mean, one could argue about that, but I certainly think that the area that she's working in, the ground she's trying to till, is exactly where the Democrats need to be and where the presumed nominee, Hillary Clinton, if she's wise, will try to be. And, you know, what does that mean? And by that, I don't necessarily mean to say that I don't think Elizabeth Warren should run. Perhaps she will, perhaps she won't. But I do think her ideas should get in there. It's possible that if she ran, that might help her ideas get in the mix. I don't know. I think it's very difficult to predict at this point what she's going to do. But I do hope that where she's coming from and her focus, that becomes an important part of the toolkit, because the lack of a compelling economic message that resonates with ordinary voters, particularly as we were talking about earlier, white working class voters, without that, I do think you're playing with fire, even in a presidential election.
Right. We're going to pause now for a break. This is Eleanor LeCain speaking with my guest, Rui Teixeira, senior fellow at both the Century Foundation and the Center for American Progress. We'll be back talking about the role of money in this election and what it means to have Republicans taking over the Congress. Okay, it seems like the break has run its course. What about labor? You know, no one's hardly mentioned labor in here, and there were times when labor's endorsement meant an almost certain victory for candidates. What was the role of labor this year? They spent a lot of money, gave some elbow grease, but, you know, how many of the candidates that labor was supporting won this year?
I don't know the figures on that. My general impression is that the record was not too good. I think the teachers union in particular didn't do that well. But, you know, it was a bad Democratic year, so I'm not sure you can blame them or really make much of an interpretation on that at all. I mean, most Democratic candidates in competitive races, no matter who backed them, didn't do too well. So, but it is true that labor doesn't have kind of the clout it once did. I mean, who it endorses or not is not quite as big a deal as it once was. Look, when you only cover 7% of the private labor force, I mean, your ability to really move the country is probably limited. And given that we're not seeing much of an uptick, in fact, none, in union density, I mean, that could be what we'll see in the foreseeable future.
Right. So let's talk about money. You know, there was a lot of conversation in the wake of the Supreme Court decisions with Citizens United and McCutcheon kind of opened the floodgates for private money and even anonymous money. We didn't know where the money was coming from, and having just, you know, millions and millions of dollars coming in from outside either the candidates or the parties. So how much money was spent in this election, and what impact did the dark money from anonymous sources play?
Well, that's a question that I think people are going to continue to debate. I mean, it's a little hard to look at all the money that was spent, even the so-called dark money, and say it was truly determinative of any election outcome. There are people who argue strenuously that other factors are really more important. I mean, that said, even given the poor environment the Democrats had to run in, even given some of their strategic decisions about how to run, which perhaps weren't the best, I think it's sort of hard to believe that showering gazillions of dollars on particular states and running no-holds-barred aggressive attack ads in massive volume against given Democratic candidates, particularly this big network that the Koch brothers are behind, was really the leaders in this. It's hard to believe it doesn't help tip the scales at least somewhat and at the margin. So I guess that would be my sense of it. I mean, it was a contributing factor, but not the determining factor. And I think, again, the Democrats have to think through what to do about this. At this point, I think the only idea they can come up with is try to spend as much money. So we'll see how that works out.
Yeah, so I think we pointed to a number of factors here, kind of message and turnout, which is related. You've got to give people a reason to turn out. And when you're looking, you know, we know generally younger people, African Americans, tend to turn out less in a midterm. But if you give people a reason to show up, they're more likely to vote. So, you know, you pointed that right from the get-go on this show about the message and the record. What are Democrats going to do?
Well, I think that's an important point, maybe worth dwelling on for a second, this issue of turnout and mobilization and the Democrats' plans for above. Seems to me that, and there were certainly a lot of stories about this famous Hispanic Street Project and so on, that I think there was a bit of a tendency to regard turnout and mobilization questions as primarily a technical issue. That if we get our, you know, lists together, we get our contacts together, we get our networks together, we get our algorithms together, we can touch every voter we need to touch, and by God, we could turn them out because we're so technologically sophisticated. Well, A, the Republicans are going to do the same thing, and they're in the process of doing it, and B, I think it's clear from this election that no matter how sophisticated your technological apparatus is, if you don't make people fairly enthusiastic about showing up, it's not going to do you that much good. I mean, the holy grail is to combine technological sophistication with some kind of compelling reason for people to show up. And then you've really got something. Then you really are able to wring every last vote out of your electorate. But failing the compelling message part and the enthusiasm part, simply having a massive technological apparatus is not going to do you that much good.
I agree with that assessment, and I'm a big fan of Get Out the Vote. I worked on Get Out the Vote for many elections, including for Elizabeth Warren and her Senate race in Massachusetts. And in a tight race, in a close race, if you have a strong Get Out the Vote operation, you can win it on the ground. But you can only win it if it's close enough to catch, you know, to get that extra push on the ground. You can't just win with Get Out the Vote. You need to have people a reason to vote. And that's, you know, you're exactly right. Of course, with Elizabeth Warren, we had both. You know, she had a great message and we had a great ground game. In fact, we broke all records in Massachusetts campaigning for our work on Get Out the Vote. So, she's just awesome and aced it and won that Senate seat there in Massachusetts. So now she's out there and I think doing a great job. It's interesting for me looking ahead to 2016. You mentioned Hillary Clinton possibly running. Some people have talked about Elizabeth Warren running. She keeps saying no. But it's interesting to me, they seem to represent two wings of the Democratic Party, that Hillary tends to be more of the Koch you know, the pro-corporate, closer to Wall Street, whereas Elizabeth Warren is more challenging Wall Street and wanting to push for things like increasing the minimum wage and getting the student loan rates down for students. So do you think that's the right assessment, and do you think they're representing the two wings of the party?
Well, I certainly think it's true that at this point in time, the real divisions in the Democratic Party are over economic issues, broadly speaking, how populist should you be, what your attitude toward Wall Street is, and how aggressive an economic program you're gonna have. They're not about social issues anymore. You know, if you hark back to the days of the Democratic Leadership Council and the New Democrats and the Clinton era, a lot of the debates were about how to deal with social issues like same-sex marriage, abortion rights, what have you. That's not a debate anymore. That's settled. I mean, Democrats are pretty much agreed on all this among themselves. They finally all agree on doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. And the Republicans are gradually caving on all this, and it's clear the direction the country is moving in. But what's not settled is what is your economic program that's actually going to produce this broadly shared prosperity the Democrats are supposed to stand for? What kind of investments is that going to take? What is going to be your attitude toward Wall Street? What is going to be your stance on budget and fiscal issues? How important do you think the national debt is? And so on. These are matters that are not settled. And certainly Elizabeth Warren is more to the left of the Democratic Party in this, and Hillary is more toward the center, which doesn't mean that she can't be moved, and in fact, you know, might very well move in Elizabeth Warren's direction, because that seems like the appropriate course to take at this point. People's views change over time, both substantively and in response to political pressures.
Right, exactly.
So, you know, we'll see where she winds up, but I'd be very surprised if she ran a 2016 campaign that was particularly corporate friendly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, speaking of the economic agenda, one of the bright spots in this election was around the referenda for increasing the minimum wage. So there were 5 states had the minimum wage increase on the ballot, and voters passed it everywhere. You know, even in the red states of South Dakota, Arkansas, Nebraska, and Alaska, as well, of course, you know, San Francisco and Oakland voting for it, but they all voted to raise the minimum wage. So we have something to cheer about in this election.
Yeah, well, I think that's the kind of thing that makes Democrats sort of question their sanity. I mean, on the one hand, they got their butt kicked. On the other hand, whatever progressive policies were on the ballot, they actually did quite well, minimum wage being example number one, but there were others. So, and you can actually see that in the exit polls, which also showed people's support for the minimum wage, on balance support for same-sex marriage and so on, and for keeping abortion legal. The views of most voters, including even the voters in this election, despite how they were a relatively conservative subset of voters, are, you know, really in a lot of these, you know, wide array of policy issues on Democrats' side. But somehow that didn't translate into votes, and that just drives them nuts.
Right. So maybe if they're a little more outspoken about the economic program that helps improve people's lives, maybe that'll help improve their lives at the ballot box. But what do you think is going to happen now in Congress? The Republicans had controlled the House for a while. Now they're controlling the Senate also, and the House kept passing all this crazy legislation, and thank God it got blocked in the Senate. Now the Republicans control the Senate. So, what do you expect to see the Republicans doing now that they control both houses of Congress?
Well, there's certainly been some talk that since they control both houses of Congress now, they have an increased share of the blame or credit for governing, that they will be moved in the direction of trying to actually pass some legislation and making some compromises with President Obama. I've got my doubts about that, because if you look at the way this election changes both the House and Senate Republican caucuses, it moves them to the right, not to the center. Now, maybe, you know, the establishment Republicans, they whisper enough in their ears and they all come to their senses and they realize their best chance for 2016 and to hold on to what they've already got is to strike a more moderate pose and try to actually be at least somewhat cooperative in Congress. But I'm not so sure that case is going to be easily made to a lot of these legislators on the Republican side and in the Senate, and particularly the House. Just because they acted a little bit less crazy in this election, right? They moderated their stances, like someone like Joni Ernst, Cory Gardner, you know, tried to portray themselves as probably substantially more moderate than they actually are. But they are who they are.
Right.
And it just may be hard for the Republican caucus to get around that. So I'd like to see more cooperation in Congress. I'd like to see some bills get done. I'd love to see immigration reform happen. But I look at the composition of the Republican caucus in Congress, and it doesn't make me full of confidence.
Yeah, and I'm a little concerned about what the cooperation might mean. You know, for example, the new trade agreement here with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which I didn't hear anyone talk about on the campaign trail, and yet it could dramatically shape the trade agreements here for years to come. And Obama seems to support it, and the Republicans, you know, see it as kind of a pro-business growth strategy. So I'm concerned that could just rush right through, along with the increase of the, allowing the Keystone Pipeline to be built. I mean, I think there's some dangerous things that could come out of this.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's clear that their greatest incentive for cooperation with the president and with Democrats are going to be on bills that are quite business friendly, or essentially on the right of the conceivable agenda. So, you know, ideally, what the Democrats would want to do is cut deals on other types of legislation. We'll actually get something that would be, you know, more utility and more in sync with their, you know, longer term agenda. But I think you're right. The danger lies that, you know, they'll say, oh, okay, we got to cooperate some with the new Republican controllers of Congress, and the only thing they'll cooperate on is the trade agreement and the Keystone Pipeline. So that's what we'll do.
Right.
So we can appear to be extending the paw of friendship. Well, I would just remind them, the last time they put a lot of effort in extending the paw of friendship to the Republicans after the 2010 election, it wound up very badly for them.
Right. Right. So looking ahead now, since it's so depressing to look at what happened this week, what do you think the Democrats need to do to win in 2016? We've talked about, the economic message. If you were advising the head of the Democratic Party or people who want to run in 2016, what are the top three things you think the Democrats need to do to win in 2016?
Well, it's always, I think that the general idea about what you talk about, i.e. the economy and how to make it work for most people, is central. I mean, what are the components of that? That is where there'll be considerable debate. I mean, for example, there could be a plank around education, college access for all. I think that is something most people want, and that most people realize is tremendously important for them over the long haul. I mean, there could be a plank around, what are we going to do about our aging infrastructure, and just generally about investing in that part of America, which would both be job-producing and would actually do us a lot of good over the long haul, the sort of invest in America approach. That could be part of it. And then there could be a whole area around basically increasing wages in some way, manner, shape, or form, from raising the minimum wage, of course, to tying to basically give, for example, there are proposals to give tax preferences to employers that raise wages as opposed to employers that do not. There's a variety of innovative ideas out there about, hey, we have a problem here that when the economy expands, we don't seem to raise wages. Well, okay, let's figure out some ways to do that. So I think if you're able to put together a package that tied in education, investing in America, and raising people's wages through various means, and actually sounded like it might work, and you stuck to your guns and you didn't get intimidated because, hey, wait a minute, some of that would cost money, and, you know, the national debt is going to crush us all in like 3.5 years, which will be a problem because there's a fiscal Hawk caucus in Washington, and even some within the Democratic Party who resist any attempt to spend money on anything. But I don't think, again, the Democrats can be afraid of that, just as they can't be afraid of, for example, if they talked about tying wages to profits and to expansion of employment, that they'd be tarred with sort of interfering with the prerogatives of the free market. You got to be willing, you know, no guts, no glory, I would say, in mm-hmm. respect.
Right, exactly. And we had Ralph Nader on the show a few weeks ago talking about his new book, Unstoppable, The Emerging Left-Right Coalition to Dismantle the Corporate State. And he actually was talking about the potential for left and right to come together on a whole series of things that are very significant, not just kind of the muddling middle, but actually come together around, you know, excessive spending in the military budget with no accountability, so let's audit it, let's cut it where we can, about civil liberties. And he laid out 25 different ways that are particular topics where the left and right could come together and make some progress. And do you see much hope of some, you know, real cooperation with the left and the right on things that really matter? I mean, not just compromising to advance the pro-corporate agenda?
Well, I think that's something you've always got to be open to. I'm not convinced that the elected representatives that are on the right, say in Congress, would be particularly interested in that sort of thing, but you never know. I mean, I'd hold out more hope for people who think of themselves as being fairly conservative as voters, but who are open to some of these kinds of steps that Nader might have been talking about, and, you know, trying to build up some support for it that way and putting some issues in play that might generate more support from that part of the political spectrum. But, you know, when you look at the hard right in Congress, if that's who he's talking about, I see their desire of cooperating with Democrats as nil. So, therefore, hard to make a sale. I think you're probably better off, you know, I mean, first let's get to the center, then we can get to the right.
Right, exactly. So what advice do you have for progressives right now? Like, you know, this is very demoralizing and depressing to get shellacked like this. You know, what advice do you have for our listeners who care about the country, care about their communities, care about progressive values? You know, we feel let down by our national leaders in the Democratic Party, and concerned about where the voters have gone. What can we do?
Well, as a former leader of the Democratic Party put it, keep hope alive. I think there are reasons for optimism in some respects. One is that the way the country is changing demographically continues to advance sort of progressive interests and move in the progressive direction. Every year it happens. Every 4 years, you have 2 percentage points more minority voters in the presidential electorate, and that's something that's taking place in pretty much every state in the country. So there's grounds for thinking that can continue and should be helpful. I think if you look at the actual policies that most progressives tend to advocate, a lot of them are quite popular with people, and there's and one of the underlying reasons why the Republicans have done so well recently, oddly enough, is that they're taking advantage of the underlying angst about inequality and poor economic performance and how that's translating into people's ordinary lives and their wages and incomes and so on. And that's obviously, potentially, a sense of disquiet and frustration that can be turned in a progressive direction if you work at it. And that's, I guess, precisely what progressives need to continue to do, to kind of press for a more robust economic narrative and a more robust economic program and realize you've got the public on your side, and you've got electoral logic on your side as well. I mean, I think the case is clear that Democrats can't really get to where they want to go without moving down that path. So I think progressives have a huge role to play in continuing to advocate for that and trying to get Democrats to stop being so damn timid.
Right. Well, you work at not one but two major think tanks, which is where a lot of the proposals for narrative and proposals for economic agendas come out. Who do you think is doing the best work in terms of creating a robust narrative and a bold program that could really help Democrats win next round?
You mean among the think tanks?
Yes.
Well, I think, you know, the Center for American Progress has put out a lot of good stuff that, you know, if adopted wholesale by the Democrats would probably be helpful. I think the Economic Policy Institute does some very good work. The Center for Budget and Policy Priorities does excellent work. Century Foundation plays a little bit less in this space, but they have some excellent stuff. I don't think there's any dearth of good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're out there for candidates and voters who are interested. And the only thing I can, you know, think of for people to do is just keep on consuming this stuff and keep on pushing it. But I think, you know, on the sort of hopeful side of things, I think that if you look at most, you know, left-oriented think tanks and opinion leaders today, they're it's kind of hard to find those who are like, you know, have a more orthodox neoliberal agenda, that it's all about free trade, the free market, deregulation, and that will produce the results that we desire. I think those people are scarce on the Democratic side these days. And so even if there's a lot of timidity, I think there's a lot of support for a generally pretty progressive program in the economic realm.
Well, that's encouraging. And for our listeners who are interested in learning more about your work, what do you recommend? Do you have a website or a book you'd like them to read?
I would just, you know, Google up my name, Rui Teixeira, and I think a lot of my recent pieces will come up. They're scattered around in a variety of different places. In particular, I have some longer pieces that have come out in the last few years about the nature of today's politics and the rise of the Obama coalition, its potential problems. And very close to home or the present time, I just put out a piece that's on the web today, just went up an hour ago, called The Politics of the Great Recession, which explains the 2014 election results and has some ideas on how both Democrats and Republicans, for that matter, can move forward. So I think that's worth taking a look at.
And what's that website address?
Oh, it's just the Center for American Progress website.
Okay, great. So listeners who want to learn more, go to that website. And as you say, there's no lack of good narrative and progressive ideas out there. Center for American Progress has them, and EPI and the other centers you mentioned. What do you think is the biggest block to those narratives and that the bold economic program being adopted by Democrats, either individually or as a party, in order to help the American people and win elections?
Well, by and large, I think the biggest obstacle is the perception on the part of many Democratic leaders that, and they are nudged in this direction by some of the money people in the party who tend to be fairly conservative on economic issues, but the perception that if they're bolder on economic program, they'll lose votes. I mean, it'd just be too heady a brew for the average voter. So that's a real obstacle, because in the end, politicians believe in getting elected perhaps more than anything else. And if they're convinced that that is going to hurt them, then they're just less likely to do it. And don't forget also, I mean, always very important, and this will rear its head going up to 2016, I'm sure, and this is, again, something where some of the money people in the party push people in what I would say is the wrong direction, the sort of whole fiscal issue, the extent to which you believe or pay attention to the size of the deficit and the debt and believe that, therefore, our freedom of movement is quite restricted in terms of what we can advocate and what we could conceivably spend money on. The whole sort of fiscal Hawk caucus that I was alluding to earlier is important. And they also serves a function of scaring off a lot of politicians from certain programs or commitments, both because they buy the substantive argument, which is largely incorrect about how we're in a debt crisis, and because they worry that voters can't possibly get around that argument made by the other side. So I think the whole fiscal issue, how to handle it, how do you deal with budgets, how do you explain to people what, you know, what kind of commitments can you make, I think that looms pretty large in trying to figure out how to move forward in this front. And I think Democrats are probably going to have to learn that just as their opponents don't necessarily dot every I and cross every T in terms of budget stuff, they don't really have to as well. They mostly need to make clear what their commitments are and whose side they're on.
Right, and I think we're at a real choice point for the Democratic Party of, you know, some of the candidates could read this and go, you know, oh my God, we've got a real right-wing push in the country, so I better head more to the right. Or you could say, we better really put out an economic program that helps the average American if we want to recapture our ability to win votes. So it's not clear to me how this election is going to be interpreted, but I hope it goes more in the favor of let's do some economic agenda policy and program that helps Americans.
Yes, I think that's exactly the choice, and we'll see how it comes down.
Well, that's all the time we have. Rui Teixeira, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your interesting work.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LeCain with All Together Now.